This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Nation, welcome to a special edition of the NBA Team Podcast. I am one of the co-hosts for the show, Andrew Reich. I do the writing over at placetobenation.com for the NBA, and you can listen to previous interviews that I've done with authors like Charlie Rosen, Jack McCallum, Jeff Perlman, and there will be more to follow, but I do have a unique guest today that I wanted to speak with and share his interview with all of you. I wanted to tell a story to begin, and that was that for some reason I was crazy obsessed with Game 7 of the 2010 NBA Finals. It was the Lakers and the Celtics. The series itself going into that game was okay, but then the seventh game was just it was just a weird grind out type of game. The final score was 83-79, and I can't understand why, but I was just obsessed with the game and trying to figure out what happened and why it happened. And I remember looking for, because most of the time you go to YouTube and you just see like individual performances and montages and highlight reels. Well, I found this one upload that I found really interesting. It was a breakdown of the entire Game 7 of the NBA Finals in a way in which I've never really seen it on the internet. And I realized that this guy was a first of his kind. His name is Coach Nick. That was his uploader name. That's his username. And he had a YouTube site called B-Ball Breakdown. And what he does is that he is also a coach himself by trade. And he does breakdowns and X's and O's and the play within the play for a lot of NBA games, sometimes in college. And I just thought it was so fascinating that this was basically one of the first of its kind, a regular YouTube subscriber that looks at the game within the game, because I don't think a lot of people were doing that before him. So I wanted to go ahead and introduce him right now. And his name that I know of is Coach Nick. How you doing, Coach?
I'm good. That's quite an interesting introduction. And thank you for having me on the show.
What's interesting about it?
Well, you know, it brings back a lot of memories myself. I had just started the channel in 2010 in May, pretty much when the playoffs started. So I'm not even sure I knew what the heck I was doing yet. I think I just started to figure it out right around the end of the playoffs. So that was an interesting game, and certainly we've had a lot of interesting discussions about it going forward. But yeah, I remember a lot of Celtics fans were really upset, but there were some key mistakes they made down the stretch, which basically meant that they probably didn't deserve to win.
Yeah, and I think that's where your insight as a coach by nature helps with a video like that. It's not necessarily that game had a lot of mistakes, because it did. A lot of NBA games have mistakes. But you have this keen eye to see it on the fly, and you would only have to see it, maybe replay it maybe once or twice, and you could basically figure out, okay, they were running a very specific type of a play and it broke down because of this. And I'm gonna tell you, I've been watching basketball my entire adult life. I still can't do that. How did you get that eye for watching games and watching plays like that? Is it because you became a coach so early in your life?
Well, it's a good question, because you know, I was always, as a player, I was always that guy who was a student of the game and would study it. I've gone to so many clinics, and I was a basketball manager at Wisconsin as a student for 2 years under Stu Jackson. And then, you know, Stu's assistant was Stan Van Gundy, and then another assistant was Sean Miller. So just being around that, you kind of see the game in a different way. And then certainly, you know, when you start to coach, obviously going through your own game footage is another big component of coaching the team. And so it just kind of gets easier as you go along. It's kind of like when you learn how to read music. And the better you get at it, the faster you are at being able to sit down and just play whatever it is, no matter how complicated it is. And I liken it to something like that, or even like when you're staring at the Matrix when all that stuff is flying by and what they can see is actual people. That's how it feels like it to me at this point.
Yeah, I remember a little bit of what – because I did a feature about Sean Miller for the website last year. And when I was doing his background, Miller had gotten his start under Stu Jackson, and it was Stu that basically had sent his work out to – I believe it was Herb Sendick. And Stu now works for NBA TV and also for Fox Sports 1. I remember he was also the coach of the Knicks, I believe, when Jordan got the baseline dunk on Ewing. And Stan, I never knew Stan was the coach there in college at Wisconsin for a year. That was, I always found that kind of interesting. Was that Michael Finley?
Yeah. Well, Stan Van Gundy was an assistant for a year, and then he took over. He was an assistant for 2 years when I was there. And then when I graduated, he took over because Stu left, to take over, Vancouver. And the Grizzlies, and so Stan Van Gundy was a coach for 1 year with Michael Finley in his last year, and it kind of, you know, the tough season, everyone keyed on him, they didn't do as well as they thought.
Now you obviously learned under certain names and that became NBA coaches or familiar faces, like we already mentioned, Stu Jackson, Stan Van Gundy, Sean Miller in college. But what were your inspirations and people, coaches that you had aspired to preach their nature? When you became a coach yourself, whether it was in high school, youth league, or rec league, or whatever it was that you became a coach in the beginning?
Well, having grown up in Chicago in the 80s, certainly, you know, the Bulls were a real big fixture in my life. And you kind of almost learn the triangle offense just by watching them do it enough times over those years. And so without a question, I studied religiously, Phil Jackson's writings. And I would read all of his books that he had written, and certainly that was the biggest influence of them all, I would say. I'm that guy that won't call timeouts if the other team goes on a run, you know, and I try and model my behavior. I think when I was an assistant, you know, at the JV level, I was probably a bit of I yelled a lot on the court, not yelled at the players, but I'd be yelling the coaching instructions.
Demonstrative.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, as I've gotten older, I've kind of mellowed. I've realized that, you know, that's, you know, let them figure it out. Let's work on and practice on this stuff so that they can go out and be free to play and hope that enough of what you taught in practice can seep in. So Phil Jackson's it. You know, Tex Winter also became a mentor of mine. When we started to run the triangle at the high school level in L.A., he was coaching with the Lakers. And I was able to kind of, you know, accost him one day and, you know, became friendly with him. And we spent a lot of time talking about it and how we teach it. And so without question, Tex is a big, big mentor of mine. You know, down here, John Wooden is revered as, you know, the Wizard of Westwood and the best coach. But I always gravitated towards his rival at Cal, Pete Newell. And Pete Newell, you know, is sort of has written some of the best books about basketball you'll ever find. And he is a part method coach, and I completely gravitate towards the part method, where you break everything down into individual small pieces, and you drill it until they can get it, and then you don't move on until they've gotten that. And I feel like a lot of coaches either disagree with this philosophy or aren't even aware of what that philosophy means, and it's frustrating because I believe it's the best way to teach basketball.
Pete Newell's known as like the great big man coach. Was he like the pioneer of the high low, or was that somebody before him?
Well, you know, it's hard to know. I don't know if he's a pioneer of the high low. I will say he was a pioneer of the skip pass. That was a real big thing that no one ever did until he started playing, primarily because they ran like the California weave, and then they also did the reverse action. And it got so good with their cut from the weak side to the strong side that the defense had to load up all the way to the strong side and take it away. And so their only choice was to basically throw that skip pass over, and then they would back screen that and get a wide open shot. So that is one thing that comes to mind right away. But he was also the guy that could do more with less. So John,
yeah, those Cal teams were not terribly talented.
Correct. But they played harder, and if they had a lead in the last 5 minutes of the game, it was over, because before there was a shot clock, they were going to run that clock out, and they were going to be more disciplined and more in shape than you were. And so John Wooden couldn't beat those teams the last, I think, 8 times they played up until until Cal won the championship in 1960. Of course, you know, UCLA went on to a lot bigger and better things a couple of years later. But the interesting thing is that I'm friendly with Jerry Norman, who is was John Wooden's first assistant back then. And Jerry Norman actually went to Pete Newell after 1960, sat down with him in his home, and went through the entire program and how Pete Newell ran it, brought back the stuff that he liked from that, and that is when they went on their crazy good run with all those great teams.
You mentioned that you know they were out there in the West. You are a high school coach in California. How do you pronounce the name of the city? Van Nuys? Van Nuys?
It's Van Nuys. I'm not the coach there now, but yeah, it's in Van Nuys. It's called Birmingham High School, and that's where I coached for 3 years.
And so you have that little bit of West Coast. Obviously, you grew up in the Midwest. You also mentioned in some of your bios Pete Carril, who was the longtime coach from Princeton, and he pioneered the Princeton offense. But I want to ask you this. What motivated you as a coach with a coach's eye to look at these NBA games and not only upload videos diagramming the games bit by bit, but singling out specific moments, freeze frames, arrow points, and being able to do these very distinctive step-by-step analyses to make people realize what went wrong, because a lot of people get the idea in the NBA that the players don't listen to coaches. They just do what they want. And it's not really the case, but they do improvise a lot. So I think what I'm wondering is what motivated you to do that, to be in a coach's mindset and explain to YouTube's viewers why a play happened?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what it all came down to was two different things. One, I had a buddy who had been a manager for YouTube stars in 2010. And back in 2010, there were about 50 people in the world that could make six figures a year on YouTube, talking to the camera and just sort of making fools of themselves. And it was kind of mind-boggling, but it was working. So they had reverse engineered what they learned from them. And this guy, my buddy, gave me the information as if we can then build a YouTube channel on purpose to capitalize on what they learned. So then we had to figure out, well, what was that going to be? And I had a varied background as a video editor and a web designer and a basketball coach and all sorts of things. I wrote screenplays. So I was having a hard time figuring it out. And then what gave me the most impetus was that in 2009, the Bulls and Celtics had this epic 7-game series. I believe it was, you know, Derrick Rose's first year. And everyone was going crazy about how amazing these games were. And all I could think was, this is some of the worst basketball I've seen. And Vinny Del Negro was coaching the Bulls, and they were guarding Ray Allen in a way that Ray Allen, I think, averaged 50, 60 points a game. It was something.
Yeah,
it wasn't that much.
He scored 50 points in the triple overtime game. Yeah.
Yeah, it was insane. And the way they were guarding it was so bad that no one was saying anything about it, that I said, you know, this is something I could do. You know, I could get in here and explain how you're supposed to play weak side defense man-to-man against a shooter like that. And that was my main impetus. And that sort of was sort of poking the hole in what the media memes had been emerging and had control of for so long. Here was a chance to finally give a little bit more of a glimpse into what really is happening, what really should be happening.
So you obviously mentioned that because of a game like that where the Bulls were playing the Celtics and there were so many defensive lapses in a series where people were not noticing it unless you were really analyzing it with the eye of somebody who actually knows how to coach those things. I want to ask you this. In the NBA, what do you think is the biggest portion of why a lot of these plays happen when you analyze a lot of these all these plays from week to week and day to day almost during the NBA playoffs? Do you think it comes from the players being undisciplined or not being willing to listen to the advice from the coaches on how to play certain players? Or do you think it's the coaches not showing the players what to do?
You know, it's funny because, you know, there's a couple different possibilities. Obviously, either the coach isn't drilling it or he is and they're not listening to them. Both of those reflect poorly on the coach. And so, you know, if I keep seeing the same kind of, you know, defensive rotations. And by the way, when you take a job as an NBA coach, you are agreeing to be criticized by everybody, including guys like me. And I you have to accept that because, of course, I don't know what's going on in the practices. Maybe this guy showed up late for the practice, so he's going to get less playing time. And, you know, that's a whole cascade of things that I don't know about. And I'm simply judging him on, you know, what it sounds like, what it looks like. However, You know, the bottom line is I think that there are coaches out there that don't see the game in a detailed way. And that's just sort of, you know, that people are people, and some people are detail oriented and some aren't. And the other part of the equation at the NBA level is the communication. And I'll give you an example. We had asked Trevor Ariza who his favorite coach was, and he certainly played for a number of them. And he said Phil Jackson. I said, oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, why? And he said that Phil Jackson gave him the most freedom on offense of any coach he'd ever had. And I kind of, you know, thought that was interesting because I watched those games when he was with the Lakers. He didn't have any freedom to do anything he wanted to do. But Phil Jackson convinced him that he did. And that is the key to a good coach.
Stockholm syndrome.
Yes, exactly. He loves the captors. So the key here is, at the NBA level, the communication has to be at such that, you know, these guys are making more than you, and, you know, they're already sort of conditioned. They're conditioned to need a coach because they've needed a coach their entire lives, but it becomes this weird, you don't want to be adversarial to them, so you have to come up with ways to communicate what you need. Another reason why I like the PART method is because if you drill the PART method, it's very clear very quickly in a drill, let's say, that so-and-so is not doing it well or not doing it hard or not focusing on it. If you play a 5-on-5 all the time and do a 5-on-5 drills, you know, you can hide. It's a lot of feet, a lot of arms, a lot of bodies moving around. You do a 2-on-2 drill, you're exposed for everyone to see. And so I feel like the practices that I have observed in the NBA, the ones that are good, do a lot of apart method stuff. Don't talk that much, honestly. They get in there, they make their point quickly, and then they get in there and they drill muscle memory. So, but then again, there are those coaches that simply don't do that. They don't drill enough. And so as a result, their players, you know, don't have the tools. It's probably, you know, more often than not that the coaches are doing something that relates to what the errors are, and they're just simply not catching it. You know, for the most part, most NBA players want to do what the coach wants them to do, you know, if it's communicated properly and they understand the motivation. So, you know, it's a real fine line, but there's no question, like last year with Mike Woodson, what they were doing on defense, they had a particular rotation that clearly was coached, and it was so mind-bogglingly bad, I guess, for lack of a better word, that you know, it just made me really to scratch my head and wonder, like, how they could come up with that.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you that to follow it up. Can you tell the difference just by watching with the naked eye between a badly drawn up play and just no play?
Yes, you can definitely tell that because, you know, if it's a drawn up play, you know, the players are going to move somewhere with a purpose. You know, you can kind of tell they cut and they move. They might miss the screen. The guy might go early before the screen's there, and it's not, you know, you can't use the screen. But when you don't have, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, my computer screen just went black.
Let me give you an example. Like, yeah. LeBron, when he scored his 49 points, you kept saying over and over again in your analysis, the Heat doesn't run a play. It's just LeBron going to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Okay, if you're talking about, yeah, offensive just flow, certainly there's a lot of instances where you might run, like, motion, which is just, you know, you have sort of vague philosophies of how you want to cut and move based on where the ball is. But, no, what we would do with the Heat, for instance, is we would chart the play calls. And you could see when they called the set, you know, then they would scramble to a specific spot to start the half-court set, and then they would move from there. And so it was as random as could be, to the point where we couldn't figure out what they were doing and why. And at some point, I almost got the impression that they didn't know either, which is sort of what, getting back to your point about, you know, do stars, you know, control the game? Do they even need the coach, or are they the ones calling the plays? Because with the Heat, you know, some of the best sets they had that they would run, they would never run them. You know, they would run it once in like the third quarter, once, and they'd get a great shot out of it, and then you wouldn't see it again for two quarters in a row, you know? And so what we were able – my theory on that is the reason why they had stretches where guys like Battier and Chalmers and their role players struggled mightily from the field is because when you don't run sets where they know where their shots are coming and there's a rhythm, then it's really hard to shoot. It's really hard to shoot consistently.
And no one's trying to make flare screens.
Exactly. And they're not like in the same spot every time. And not that they, not that I want them in the same spot every time, but when you run, when you watch the Spurs play, you know, Danny Green's probably got like four ways he gets his shots, right? And the pass is going to come from one of these four angles, and you're going to be in one of these like three perimeter spots. You know, it's literally that scientific for a guy like him, and he's a, as a role player, that really helps. But when the Heat started going and running their offense, you know, it was just random. And Battier would never be in the same spot. There would never be a rhythm for him and Chalmers. And even Mike Miller would go, went through stretches. And, you know, that is where it kills you because it's the role players that need those plays to get them shots. And it's the role players who get more of those easy shots that, that allow you to win the game.
The thing I really loved about the YouTube channel, even before you launch your own website, just to get it out there, he also has bballbreakdown.com, where they do a lot of written pieces and breakdowns and such about the game of basketball, whether it be college, mainly NBA. But even on the YouTube channel for years, and even going forward, Coach Nick will dabble into classic breakdowns. Like he will take a retro game, like I remember one time you did the 1975 Western Conference Finals back when the Bulls were still in the West and they played the Warriors. And I just thought it was so fascinating. Like he probably caught this on NBA TV one time, and he can just see all these things that they were running in the 1970s that I couldn't even imagine them, people knowing how to run that stuff. And one that I thought that was really cool was that you did the 98 NBA Finals, the Game 6, where Michael hit the last shot. I've seen that game a million times. But you show things in the game, whether it was the play where Ron Harper did not beat the shot clock, mm-hmm. or if it was, you know, Jeff Hornacek running a UCLA cut. And I'm like, I don't see those things, but it's just so fascinating. But I want to ask you this in relation to those older games. Do you see the coaching in the NBA today as an advancement upon what they were doing in the 80s and in the 70s and maybe even in the 90s? Or do you feel like things have gotten more predictable and more by the numbers because of the new rules?
I would say up until this year, and it's weird because this year is an anomaly where you have so many teams are influenced by the triangle and by sort of Princeton stuff and Spurs motion. Up until to this year, I think that the golden age of the NBA was the late 70s. I think right after the ABA merged and you had this influx of incredible talent, you also had structured offense. And you would see these world-class athletes and fantastic basketball players running UCLA high post. And they run triangle. And they would run Princeton. And it was very organized. And they would get great shots all the time. And you couldn't do anything on defense because it was so good. So my take on it is that was when it was the golden age, and maybe we'll get back to something like that now going forward with some better coaches and some better systems. But there's no question. The one thing that has improved, obviously, is the defense. I think that back in the day, they didn't really have a semblance of a real understanding. Now, you go back and you look at a guy like Pete Newell, and he had some really good fundamental ideas about how to play man-to-man properly. But the notion of no middle defense is what I learned from Stu Jackson and Sam Van Gundy at Wisconsin, you know, wasn't as prevalent as it is now when you see Coach Thibodeau and with the Bulls running it with their ice defense and forcing everything away from the middle. I think we're now realizing that that's the best way to do it, and so all these teams are able to now play better positional defense, making it a lot harder on the offense to get shots, which, of course, has now made it a premium to find a coach that has a good system that can generate better shots again. So we're kind of going back and forth on this one as the defense got too good. Now the offense is coming back. But anyway, no question that the defense is the one thing that's really improved and the philosophy has improved compared to back in the day. But I think the offense back in the late 70s was the best I'd seen.
You mentioned Tom Thibodeau as the coach of the Chicago Bulls, and he was also an assistant coach for that FIBA World Cup team. You also did breakdowns of some of those games, and you mentioned how effective the defense was because he's one of those guys that loves to force stuff away from the middle. But don't you think that's a little scary now because of the fact that if you force him out of the middle, you could probably scare him to the point where they would get to the three-point line and be able to get at least one pass away from a good shot, so you would have to be able to defend the three-point arc and you would have to try to trap him into the mid-range, which has now become surprisingly the worst shot in the NBA when it was probably the most effective one in the 1990s.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, positionally, if you play no middle defense correctly, then you're not going to give up that. All you're going to give up is, like, at the most, is sort of a drive where you're angling the guy down to the baseline, and then the big guy can come over and help and make it a tough shot without fouling. When you let him go into the middle, that's when all the fouls happen, and that's when all the crazy shots go in. I can't tell you, at every level I've ever been around, you let a guy get in the middle of the court, and all of a sudden, a guy who is a role player looks like Dr. J, and the shots just start raining down. It's really a strange thing, but it makes sense because when you're in the middle of the lane, you know, you're more straight onto the basket, and you can get rolls off the backboard easier, and there's all sorts of things that happen there. And so, I think that, you know, I'm a strict no middle guy. It was funny because I ran into to Stu Jackson recently, and he says he wouldn't play it that way anymore. And basically, and neither did Stan Van Gundy, said the same thing. And it was like my image of basketball as I knew it was shattered at my feet, because the two guys that taught me that said they weren't going to really do it that much. That said, I've talked to other coaches who said they don't do it, and then you watch them play, and all their players have moved their feet, and you can see how they move their feet when they're guarding the wing. That's clearly forcing them down to the baseline and not letting them middle. So it kind of has crept in, even if they don't think they're doing it.
This one's always bugged me for years, and I know I'm not smart enough to know it, so I'm going to have to ask you, because I know you know it. Did the Dallas Mavericks win the NBA championship playing zone defense?
Well, I mean, certainly they played zone defense and they won the championship. I don't know how you want to.
It was like a morph of zone defense it was like an amoeba defense. It was weird.
Yeah. Now, and I coached the amoeba as well. You know what it looked like more to me, and I probably should go back now and do a retro breakdown and look at it. But if that can still be considered a retro, it's not quite old enough. But here's what I think, and what I've heard from bits and pieces. And one day I'm going to get Mark Cuban on the show. We're going to interview him and find out. But here's what I think that they were doing. They obviously have really high-level analytics. And so, first of all, they had charted – what we had done earlier last year was we charted where LeBron James started each half-court possession. Not where he shot the ball, but where he started it. And then we looked at the results. Did he shoot it? Did he not get it? Did he whatever? And we found out that there were certain spots on the floor where if he started there, you didn't have to worry about him. And if he started here, you better worry he's going to shoot and he's going to score a lot of points. I have no doubt that, A, the Mavericks were aware to some degree of this. Plus, they were just backing off and daring him to shoot. B, I think they also had lineup studies where they knew based on which five of theirs was out versus which five of the Heat was out, they knew what play to call on offense to get a good shot. And they knew that the Heat were not going to adjust.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was thinking too, that the Heat were so stubborn that they could just sit back in their defense and know it was going to stay effective.
Right. And so, you know, I think that offensively they were really challenged as it was that year, just relying on their good looks. And when you start to take away the one thing that offense is supposed to do, that one set, you're supposed to throw the ball there. Well, you take that away, then a lot of it dies. Another reason why, like the triangle, because there isn't ever one pass that you have to make. And so that they really were able to catch them with their pants down. And, you know, subsequently, they got better at it, obviously. But, you know, you could argue that they didn't really beat the Spurs that second year because it took, you know, an act of God, of which we'll never see again, for them to pull out that game, which was a closeout game. And we easily could be sitting here, you know, hailing the Spurs as two-time champions. Well, it would have been a much more interesting narrative, I think.
The weird thing about the Game 7, and you said it in your breakdown too, and that, I think that was even stranger than the end of Game 6, is that the Heat ran good offense and the Spurs ran bad offense, which I've never seen in a clutch game by the San Antonio Spurs, even before that. You know, it was just such a weird out-of-nowhere thing where the Spurs all of a sudden seemed to forget how to run their offense, and the Heat just kind of like all of a sudden figured it out.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. In fact, we saw it again with Chris Paul in Game 5 against OKC last year, a guy that makes every decision correctly, had the worst, you know, 80 seconds of his career, and basically, you know, you could argue that that was the series, that game. And, you know, it's kind of nice in a way to be able to see that and realize that these guys are human and it doesn't always work out.
That was last season that you were talking about with the Chris Paul meltdown in Game 5. We'll talk a little bit about this season. The season's very young, obviously. We don't really know what we're in for, even though you do see a few things every now and then that interest you. What are the things that have intrigued you so far, whether it be the Cleveland Cavaliers offense being pretty good potentially, but still trying to figure it out? I know you're pretty enamored with what the Golden State Warriors have been doing under Steve Kerr versus what they were doing under Mark Jackson before that. I'm fascinated with the Phoenix Suns under Jeff Hornacek. Like, I don't know how they're winning games. So what is it that you see lately from whatever team it be, whether it be New Orleans or San Antonio or the Clippers, that you've kind of – that's really perked your interest so far?
Well, two things are interesting to me. That first of all, you have a Princeton coach with the Lakers and Byron Scott, and then you have a Princeton-influenced coach at the Cleveland Cavaliers, both of whom in the preseason showed some good offensive sets. They were executing well. And as soon as the regular season started, it like went out the window. I don't think I've ever seen that before, where it was working in the preseason, and then, you know, for the Lakers specifically, it's completely fallen apart. They're not running anything that they had worked on that they displayed in the preseason. That's very strange to me. And it's probably a little bit less strange with Cleveland because they are that talented that they can kind of get away with it. But it's very strange, and almost like it was someone making a decision. So, you know what? We're not going to do these sets anymore, guys. This is what we're going to do. Very strange. Golden State, beautiful. The Knicks, another thing. They looked like they had started out well, and they were getting good ball movement, and they were, you know, being somewhat successful with the triangle. And now they've kind of gotten back reverted, and which is probably also to be expected with a new coach and a new system with the same players from last year. So that might be a little bit more to be expected. But, you know, those are the things that caught my eye. I tell you one more thing that caught my eye on Twitter was that, you know, I'm a math guy. I taught math in high school. I like statistics, and I like the advanced stats. We use them all the time. However, something popped up recently where you were at home, and you're down by two with 10 seconds to go, and you have the ball, and all these stats probability guys are coming out of the woodwork saying that you must go for the three. It is not even a question. This probability for this two-pointer plus the overtime, three-point shot is better. And I asked a couple of my coaching friends about that, and they all said to me, yeah, those guys have never sat on the bench and coached a team. And when you realize that, you know, the only way I would ever consider shooting a three when I'm down by two at the last shot is if I'm attacking the basket and then I see I can get a kick out for the open three. But sometimes these coaches will just run some pin down. The guy is catching the ball going away from the basket, has to turn and fire up a three with a guy's hand in his face. That's just a recipe for losing, no matter what you say. And the probability people seem to grade a three-point shot the same way all the way across the board. And that's what's really frustrating to me when you start talking, because these guys want to talk in absolutes. And they want to say, of course you're an idiot for not shooting a three, because this math shows us over the last 30 years, 2 + 2 = 4. And I'm saying, that's not how it works in basketball.
No, there's a practicality to it.
Absolutely. This three-point shot here is not the same three-point shot here at a different time. And what could a game played 4 years ago with 10 different players across the country have any effect on my team now? That's how I look at it for the most part. Certainly, if you're up by three and the other team has the ball and you should foul, okay, that's an interesting thing. That's a defensive thing. But when we start talking about offense – and those things, I just get real frustrated because there's way too much nuance to be so absolute.
We talked obviously mostly about NBA basketball. You do talk a little bit about college. You did a few of the NCAA tournament games. And I do want to talk about your best friend, John Calipari, because you skewered him in the national championship game, yeah. Probably rightfully so, for some really critical mistakes that he made where he refused to foul because he thought that they were going to make free throws, even though you're never going to know if you don't foul him. And he didn't call timeouts in certain moments. He didn't call good plays for the team. Not saying that John Calipari is a terrible coach. He just had a slip-up at the end. I'm bringing him up because he's gaining a lot of steam lately because of this new – have you heard about the new platoon system that he's going to do in Kentucky?
I saw a headline.
So basically they're going to run the same squads – where it's one and then they have the second team come in, kind of like the posse. You remember Perry Clark with Tulane, where he would have that starting five and then he would have five just jump right in and just take over. Do you think that this is just Calipari doing his salesmanship techniques again, or do you think this is a sort of extreme version of coaching that might actually work?
I mean, when you got that much talent, when you have a training camp, basically a pro training camp on your campus for all the NBA players or GMs to come and watch, you know, I've seen it. I was part of it in high school one year. They tried it, you know, like that, subbing five at a time. And, you know, I won't hold that against him. If he's got that much talent, you know, and he's got to figure out how to get minutes for them, that certainly seems to be, you know, a democratic way to do it. I know that Phil Jackson experimented with that as well in the CBA, and it actually worked out okay there. So, you know, I will not criticize his decision to try, you know, the platoon system.
What's more maddening for you to watch when you analyze plays? The players kind of going into business for themselves in the NBA, or the over-delicate over-coaching in college?
What's more maddening to watch? Well, it's interesting. You know, because college is not the college game that I grew up with. I don't watch it that often anymore. And then usually around, you know, March Madness, I got to quickly try and watch as much as I can to do some of those breakdowns. And when that happened in the last couple of years, I was watching these games and I'm like, this is not the execution that I remember. You know, this is not the college basketball. They would have, you know, 4-year players and they would run the crap out of their offense and it was beautiful. Now it is a bit maddening because they're doing stuff that like maybe they got from the pros a little bit, but they're not good enough quite to do that. And then they're not staying very long, so they don't have enough experience. So college is certainly could be a maddening, experience to watch these days. But certainly if you watch a basketball game, an NBA game that, is real loose, doesn't have a lot of, structure either, that's pretty close to being the same amount of maddening.
But you like the swing offense though with Bro Ryan, huh?
No, I don't.
You don't like that one?
My problem with the swing offense, although it's kind of, I kind of liked it a little bit better last year, but at some point when he'd bring the big man out and they'd pass to him on top of the key, they would simply deny the wing, and the big man's not going to dribble the ball. So he's stuck up there having to, like, you know, try and attack on his own because it's a real simple way to shut that offense down. It was really frustrating. They've kind of figured out some counters. It's gotten better, and obviously they've elevated their game to Final Four levels. But that was my issue with the swing, you know, at least earlier on. But I will say last year with what they were doing with what's his name? Kamenitsky? Is that his name?
Frank Kaminsky. Mm-hmm.
Frank Kaminsky. There was good stuff there, and I definitely enjoyed watching that more. And there's no question that that's what kept them in those games against those teams like Kentucky.
Did you graduate from Wisconsin and Madison?
I did.
Okay, so but do you watch like do you follow him like rah rah like when Aaron Harrison hit the shot in the Final Four? Did it like just totally deflate you, or did you see it still in the mind of okay, this is why this happened, and yeah, I can explain it?
You know, I tend to be not really a fan of a logo. I tend to be a fan when I was a fan of the players and their stories and who they were, and that's what I gravitated towards. I definitely felt some strange, you know, some fandom was creeping out of me watching that game, you know, some visceral notion of, you know, I went to Wisconsin, I got to cheer for them, and I couldn't control it. Same as it happens every once in a while with the Bulls, even though I'm not really a fan of the Bulls. I watch basketball and I enjoy watching all the teams. So, but the reason why it was heartbreaking to watch that shot was because there was no play. You know, it was a total, you know, mistake almost. They didn't run a play. Calipari didn't give them anything to be organized with, and they still were successful. And that's what's really maddening is when, you know, it was they were in good position. They contested the shot right. That's the stuff that's not supposed to give you success, and yet they were able to do it anyway.
Yeah, I was a Bulls fan myself. I do like sometimes the comments that come in there, like, well, oh, you obviously don't like Kobe Bryant because you think Michael Jordan's the best ever. Well, duh, Michael Jordan is the best ever. But, you know, Kobe Bryant, he's one of your favorites, or do you think that people think that you criticize him too much?
Oh, you know, anybody who's a fan of Kobe, you know, it's really difficult to say anything about him negative. You know, it is. It's just they're very protective, and I understand that. I suppose I was as protective as of Michael when I was growing up. But, you know, and there's no shame in saying that, you know, that you're not as good as Michael Jordan. it really isn't. Now, I've often said that he's not the best Laker of all time, and that really frustrates Laker fans because, obviously, you know, I'm still praising a Laker. I'm saying Kareem is probably the best or Magic is the best. You know, even maybe Jerry West was the best. But it really, it stymies them and makes them very frustrated. Kobe has been an interesting guy because I think he could have been better, even though he's got all these amazing accolades. But I feel like the mental approach to the game, and I'm not saying it's weak-minded, but it's just the way he approached the game, why he's never been able to evolve from that approach, has held him back to some degree. And that's sort of what's wrong with me when I've seen the things I don't like about it. Obviously, he's clutch, and he makes amazing shots that are ridiculously hard. But I always felt like if he just would let the offense work for him, he would have shot a lot better, scored more points, and the team probably would have won a few more games.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Coach Nick, for coming up and doing the interview. Do you have anything to promote for B-Ball Breakdown, or whether it be .com or whether on your YouTube channel?
Sure. Well, you know, we were doing a lot of cool stuff now on our YouTube channel weekly, where we have a horns set of the week, our horns, top five horns plays of the week every Monday. And that's been a real fun thing where every team runs this certain set and we show you our favorites from that week. And then we launched our .com in the beginning of October, and it's been an amazing journey over the last 6 weeks, and we're killing it out there. People are flocking to the website mainly because it's some of the best writing I've read. The head editor is this guy, Mark Deeks, out of England, who is a CBA expert and understands everything about contracts. And he has assembled an incredible crack team of writers who are analyzing the game in ways we haven't seen before and are written in such high quality that it's really a pleasure for me to go on there and see what's coming up next. So bballbreakdown.com is now a living, thriving entity, and I definitely recommend checking it out.
And remember, guys, it's not a channel, it's a conversation.
And I'm in.
trying to get it in for you. But okay, Coach, thank you so much for coming up on the NBA Team podcast. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we're going to catch y'all off the bounce. Thanks, guys.